BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And those taking part are Anne Scott-James, Dillis Bow, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. And here's round one to test their vocabulary. Two marks if they can give me the meaning of the following words approximately right. And first, Anne Scott-James, I want to know, what is a brumby?
Oh, I should think this is a sort of Lewis Carroll portmanteau word. It's obviously a zombie from Birmingham. Brum being Birmingham.
Now, you've got to go further away, very, very much further away than Birmingham.
Further than Birmingham?
Yes. Antipodean.
Australia?
Yes. And what in Australia?
A type of kangaroo.
I'm going to give you one mark, for knowing it's an animal that comes from Australia. It is an unbroken or wild horse in Australia. Thank me. The meaning of the word fey, F-E-Y.
Fey?
Mm.
It's a word of three letters. You find it all over the world. In France, your girlfriend is fait accompli. And it means touched by the goblins, and you're not quite as other people.
Yes, I think that's good enough,
Frank. You act like a bit of a Charlie.
Yes, you've left out one bit of the definition, but I think that's good enough to get two marks. It originally means fated to die, disordered in mind, like a person about to die, and it had these undertones of hectic gaiety or overconfidence. You were supposed to turn like that when you were shortly going to die, particularly young people, doomed to death. Now to Dillis Bow. Dillis Bow, what is a jocko? J-O-C-K-O.
Jocko? It's an animal, I think.
Yes?
Kind of human animal.
It's not quite human.
Not quite human.
Can you eat it?
It's a kind of baboon.
Yes, I think that's good enough. It is, in fact, a chimpanzee.
Well.
And it comes from the French, from gaboon, from a native word, injeco. And now, Dennis Norden, the meaning of the word ventricose. V-E-N-T-R-I-C-O-S-E. Ventricose.
Well, ventry is something to do with the stomach.
Yes.
As in ventriloquist.
Huh?
Talking from the stomach.
Yes.
So, ventricose then would be the same as bellicose. It's a polite way of saying bellicose.
Now, the belly is the only right bit of this.
The rest. It's something to do with the stomach.
Yes,
somebody
right.
With a huge paunch. It must be
yes.
A stomachy type.
Yes.
Good work, Anne Scott-James, to name but a few.
Absolutely right. It's like Falstaff having a protruding belly. Well, before we start the second round, I give each team a quotation of one to write down, and the two women members of the team, then I hope, will study their quotations to the end of the programme, because then I shall ask them the source of each quotation. So that Anne Scott-James and Dennis Norden, here's your quotation. More happy if less wise. And Dillis Bowen and Frank, yours is, you come most carefully upon your hour. And then at the end of the programme, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these words came to be said or written. So to round two. And now for two marks, I want to know in what books, by what authors, you'd find the following characters. In some of the cases I'm going to quote, there are several books which go on retelling the adventures of the same characters, in which case a brief account, and I stress the word brief, of the types of book would do. Beginning with you, Anne Scott-James, the characters Scarlet and Rhett.
Oh, this takes me back to the days when I was young and handsome and romantic.
Send it.
This must be Gone with the Wind.
Yes, it is. By?
Margaret Mitchell.
Yes, two marks. Hero and Heroine have Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell, Scarlet O'Hara and Rhett Butler. Frank Muir, Claude Eustace Teal.
It comes from several books, not just one.
Yes.
All written by Mr. Leslie Charteris.
Yes.
And all featuring a chap called the Saint.
Quite right. Claude Eustace Teal was the police inspector in the series of books by Leslie Charteris featuring the Saint. Dennis Powell, Becky Sharp.
Vanity Fair.
Right.
By Thackeray.
2 marks. Dennis Norton, you've got a whole team of them. Steve Carella, Maya Meyer, Bert Kling, and Cotton Hawes.
Yes. There are 8 million stories, actually, in which these people appear. Because there's a television programme based on books by Ed McBain about the 87th Precinct, and one, there's a book called The Pusher, Cop Hater. They've all got sort of eloquent titles like that.
Splendid. 2 marks. American police detective novels about the 87th Precinct by Ed McBain, and these are some of the characters that appear. Now, the next round is origins and derivations. 3 marks are possible if members of the team can define the present meaning and then give the derivation of these words or expressions. Beginning with Anne Scott James, and your word is nicotine.
Well, nicotine means, I suppose, the extract of tobacco or tobacco juice.
Mm-hmm.
And I should have thought it came from a Latin word, but you obviously want something much...
A bit more recherche.
Yes,
than
much
that,
more
yes.
recherche than that.
And that's the right language.
It's a Frenchman, French lady, my lady, nicotine. Nicotine. When she passes by.
You're jolly nearly there.
From an old French song. No. Old French roundelay.
You're mixing it up with my lady guillotine.
Well, 1.5. It's the oily, colourless, highly poisonous alkaloid, which is found in tobacco. We all note that. But in the midst of the 16th century, there was a French ambassador of the court of Spain called Monsieur Jean Nicot. And he was given some seeds of tobacco coming from America, given them by sailors. And in the year 1560, a great date, he took them back to France and planted them there and was the first to produce tobacco in his native land. And because they knew so little about it, they named the drug in his honour, nicotine. Now, Frank Morton, nightmare.
Oh, it's a horrible dream, a nasty dream.
Yes.
That's what a nightmare is. 2 marks.
And by origin.
Oh, origin of nightmare.
Something about a succubus which sits
yes.
on you at night, isn't it?
Yes, you're getting there.
Yes.
The old grey mare sits on you at night.
That's right.
Terrible dreams because of the pressure on your chest.
That's right.
Yes.
You're rather careful.
That's about
still.
It.
It's very nearly right, but there's one particular which you've got, I think...
Very old, eh?
I think 2.5 would be right. It means nowadays an oppressive or paralysing, terrifying dream, but it comes from an Anglo-Saxon word, and it meant a female incubus or evil spirit who descended on a sleeping person and sat or lay on the sleeper's breast. And the less polite word was not nightmare, but night hag. The point I was trying to elicit from you, Frank, is it has nothing to do with horses at all.
Well, a horse could have a nightmare, sure. You see them, the upper lip draws back and sort of whiffles. And it means they're having a nightmare. You can see them.
The horses I back always have nightmares, but it doesn't help. 2.5. Now back to Dennis Powell. Your word is corny. C-O-R-N-Y.
It means kind of soft and silly and... well, I don't know.
Obvious and
unsophisticated. Sentimental and...
Yes.
Yes.
Mm. And originally?
It comes from the Corn Belt of America.
Yes.
There was a lot of corn.
Yes, there was, but... How did it come to mean this?
Because the people who grew it weren't very bright.
That was the theory. I think it's probably totally untrue.
Bangers
I'm sure they
American
were awfully bright, but still. They were very bright indeed.
You wring my heartstrings, but I think I'm only going to give you 2 marks.
No, that's a very corny remark.
Well, it means nowadays, as Dennis has said, it's an unsophisticated, out-of-date, broadish joke, with sort of rural connotations. But entertainers and theatre people generally hated not playing in town and having to go out into the sticks because they thought they would find audiences which were unsophisticated and pretty stupid and dumb. And in America, these audiences were originally referred to as corn-fed audiences. There, you were quite right, Dennis. And they were alleged to relish very broad, obvious, unsubtle jokes, and corn-fed humour became known finally as corny humour. Dennis Norden, the phrase to tip someone.
To tip someone? You really want me to explain this? It means to say to somebody, ah, my good fellow, here's something for your pain.
Yes.
I always doctor. Give them an aspirin when I say it. The origin, this must be one of the oldest human activities, tip. Well, it obviously goes miles and miles back in history, really prehistoric, when they traded in sort of stone arrows.
Yeah, for mammoth tusk.
When they traded in mammoth tusk, you'd give the mammoth tusk to somebody, and whoever arranged it, you just break off the end and say, here's a
tip. The tip. Yes, yes.
Well, that's just about as likely as the explanation I'm just about to give, so I can give you 2.5 marks.
I'll tell you now, Jack, it's likelier.
It's a small gratuity for services rendered, at least that's what it's supposed to be. It normally isn't very small. But the explanation is that in the coffee houses in the days of Dr. Johnson, they used to have a box on the table with a sort of slot in it, like a money box, and on the box were printed 3 words, to ensure promptness. The idea being that if you put the coin in the box, then the waiter came and served you, otherwise he wouldn't. The capital letters of the phrase, to ensure promptness, are T-I-P. Well, we know that phobia, at the end of a word, means hatred or fear of something. For instance, claustrophobia or agoraphobia. What for 2 marks do the following phobias indicate? Anne Scott James, to start with. Noctiphobia, N-O-C-T-I, with phobia on the end. Noctiphobia.
Noctiphobia. Well, I'm sure it's all tied up with these nightmares, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I think it's when the horse is sitting on you and you want the daylight to come. In other words, I think it's a fear of the night.
Fear of the darkness, it is. Frank Muir, xenophobia, X-E-N-O, and then phobia. Xenophobia.
Rotten game, this is. Xenophobia, it's fear of... Fear of Zeno. She didn't say yes. She didn't. Zeno. It's fear of popular songs.
Foreigners.
Fear of foreigners. My friend says it's fear of foreigners. Ignore my previous remarks.
I will. You just get home. It's a morbid dislike of foreigners. Dennis Powell. Stenophobia. S-T-E-N-O. Phobia. Stenophobia.
Fear of narrow places.
Yes.
It's typists.
Fear of narrow places. Fear of narrow places. Old chap ought not to go potholing or caving. Dennis Norden. Pantophobia. P-A-N-T-O. And phobia. Pantophobia.
It's fear of having to take 3 children at Christmas time. Yeah. And not knowing whether to join in when they say all the grown-ups now sing it and all the little boys now sing it. Not knowing whether you're classified as a little boy or whether you should wait and sing later and they'll come to you. Pantophobia.
When you're afraid of absolutely everything.
Bully for you, Anne, yes. I think it's when you're afraid of absolutely everything, actually. It's just occurred to me.
And you're dead right. It's a fear to end all fears, which is the fear of everything. Victims are thoroughly miserable at all hours of the day and night because they hate and fear everything. Must be a wonderful state to be in.
Oh, I get that. I get
2 marks
that.
It is. And now we come to the last round and go back to the quotations I gave the 2 teams earlier on in the programme. 2 marks, Anne Scott-James, can you give me the origin of your quotation? More happy if less wise.
It seems to me that what this man is saying is that the best thing is to be an absolute cabbage, but who thought that?
Somebody with pantophobia.
I don't think I'm going to be able to peg this one.
It's a very difficult one, I think.
It sounds like the end, but I don't think it is, of one of those couplets which end a Shakespearean scene. But I'm sure it isn't his thought.
It isn't. No, it's from Byron. It's a very long poem in cantos or stanzas, The Island. And it's tamed each rude wanderer to the sympathies of those who were more happy if less wise. The idea being that the civilized chap, alleged, landed on the island and found the natives, and it was the natives who taught him rather than vice versa. All right, Dennis Powell, the origin of your quotation, which was, you come most carefully upon your hour.
Well, that is Shakespeare.
Yes.
And it's Hamlet.
Yes. 2 marks. Well, now I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how their quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Dennis Norden, and more happy if less wise.
I want to tell you how psychoanalysis not only gave me peace of mind, but improved my typing. You see, I have to type a lot in my job, and my chief trouble was I could never find the letter B on a typewriter. I just couldn't see it. I could never find it. If I was typing a word, you know, I'd go along very merrily and come to a word like umbrella, and I type U-M, where's the B? Where's the blooming B? You know, where's the B? And I just couldn't see it. I couldn't find it. And so I used to leave it out, you see, which is all right with a word like umbrella, because, you know, you can more or less guess if it says umbrella. It's obviously umbrella. I mean, what else could it be? But if you get a word, you see, there were other words. For example, if you get Bangkok and you leave the B out, then it's Angkok. And even that's not so bad, because you can sort of get it from the sense of it. I got this kind of complex about the thing, and I hated sort of keeping leaving it out, so I wouldn't use words that had a B in them. And for 18 months, I never wrote a script that contained one word that had the letter B in it. You see, obviously, you can't get away with a thing like this indefinitely. Somebody's sure to notice. And it was noticed by, of course, none other than shrewd old Frank Muir, you see, who said to me one day, long time no B. Which is typical. It is typical of the Muir, you know, type of quick wit mind, you see, because it's a play upon what most people say, which is long time no see, because he's a bit of a caution, you know, and he says things like that. And so I explained to him why it was that I have this thing where I just cannot see the letter B when I'm typing. I go to find it and I can't find it, so I've given up using the word B. And I told him all this, and he said, I said, what does that mean? He says, it means you've got a psychological blockage. So I said, well, do you think I should get something from the chemists, you know? And he said, no. He said, no, you should go and see a psychiatrist. So I went to see this psychiatrist, who's one of the top chaps in the business. I mustn't tell you his name because of ethics and things, but he really is top, you know, leading chap, four couches, no waiting. And he laid me down, you see, and he said, well, tell me all about your troubles. And I told him all about this, that when I type and when I'm doing anything, I cannot find the letter B. And he heard it all, and he said, It was exactly what Frank had said, you see, so I knew I'd come to the right chap. And he said, what is happening is that your unconscious is rejecting the concept of B. So I said, do what? He said, don't you see? He said, you are rejecting B. He said, there is something in your past life of which the letter B is a painful reminder, and that's why you're ignoring it. So I said, there isn't. Wait a minute. And I remembered. It was quite right. It was, and it had gone completely out of my mind. It was about 8 years previously. And I was in this car on Wimbledon Common. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was with this speech therapist, who was a very tall girl. And this policeman came along, and he shone his torch. And they were the very words that he used. Letter B, he said. And you see what had happened? It was my mind rejecting this painful and humiliating experience, so that whenever the letter B, I ignored it. See, I wouldn't see it. And he'd found it. He was right. It was through analysis that I went straight back to the typewriter. I looked, and sure enough, he dredged up my unconscious, and there it was. I saw the letter B. It's on the bottom row, the fifth one along. And I've never had trouble with it. And I sat down straight away and wrote him a letter expressing my thanks. I said, dear doctor, thank you. I couldn't find the why. I could. And you know, ever since, I've never been able to find a why when I type. But I don't mind, you see, because I know it's all in the mind. It's all right, you see. So that is the state of my typing now. More happy if less wise.
Well, now back to Frank Muir, and the origin of your quotation, Frank, which, as you remember, was, "You come most carefully upon your hour."
I want to tell you a certain cure for snoring. There are many cures, supposed cures for snoring, ranging from attaching a cotton reel to the small of your back with adhesive plaster, right down to a diver's helmet. But the only two... the only two certain cures are my remedy and the guillotine. And of the two, mine is probably preferable. I didn't realise I snored. Like all men, I didn't believe I snored because I had no evidence that I did snore. I tried sort of waking up terribly quickly, but it was no good. I never could hear it. Then my wife recorded it on a tape recorder and played it back. I only wish I could have let you hear my snore tonight. There are certain copyright difficulties. Well, I had to do something about it. So I spoke to a doctor who knows about these things and said, "What do I do about my snore?" And he said, "Snoring, very easy. When going to bed, towel overhead, sniff Friar's balsam." Well, you know, lying back on the pillow with a towel over my face, that wasn't too bad. Then came the problem, how to sniff the balsam during the night. Then I thought of a good idea. I got a little sponge from one of those, you know, those dried-up bottles of white stuff you put on your tennis shoes. It has a little sponge in it. So I got that sponge, and I squeezed it and filled it with Friar's balsam, and I thought, well, I'll lay that on the pillow beside me. Then in the middle of the night, when I start snoring, I'll turn that way and sniff it. And I suddenly realised that wouldn't work, because it would probably go in my ear anyway. But principally, that one doesn't snore when one's on one side. One snores when the nose is pointing towards the ceiling. So I realised instantly that the only way to do this was to suspend this small sponge of Friar's balsam above my nose from the ceiling. So the first thing, obviously, was to make a mark on the ceiling above my nose. So what I did was I got a long brass curtain rod, one of those sort of tube things, and lay back in the bed and balanced it on my nose. It was about 2 foot short. So I got one of those party things that you blow and it goes, and it unrolls and a feather comes out and tickles your friend, you know. And I dipped the feather in ink. And then I attached that to the top of this curtain rod tube with adhesive plaster. Then I lay back on the bed, got it vertical, blew very hard, and it unrolled at the top and went, meh, and left a lovely little ink spot on the ceiling. So far, so good. Then there's a question of dangling something down to hold the sponge. Then how to fix it to the ceiling. I obviously couldn't screw it to the ceiling, it'd spoil it. Then I thought of one of those sink plungers. Those sort of rubber suction things with a handle. I thought if I pushed that up, I could tie it and it would just dangle. So I rushed down to Egham to buy one, but there's been a tremendous sort of epidemic of U-pipe blockages in Egham. They didn't have any, but I was very lucky. I saw one in a music shop window, of all things. It was definitely a sink plunger. It had a slightly smaller handle and it was painted gold, but it was a sink plunger in a music shop. I went in and I said, "Could I have that sink plunger?" And he said, "It's not a sink plunger, it's a wah-wah mute for trumpets." And putting the trumpet he had in his left hand to his lips, he played Stardust, woggling this thing in the front of it. Wah, 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 wah. So I said, "I'll buy your wah-wah mute, it's just what I want." Rushed home with it, climbed on my wife's shoulders, and thrust the wah-wah mute against the ink spot on the ceiling. It didn't hold. It didn't do the suction thing. But of course it's plaster, you see. You know how when you'd stick things with those suction things, you have to sort of lick round them first. I realised I had to do that. So I realised I had to smear the edge of my wah-wah mute with something sort of soft. I suddenly thought of the ideal thing, cream cheese. So I ran down to the kitchen. Do you know we hadn't got any cream cheese? All we had was some white, very crumbly stuff, very hard, dry stuff called Carefilly. So what I did was I'm sorry about this, but you know, I must think, I spat in the palm of my hand and I crumbled the Carefilly and I wetted it and rubbed it into a sort of putty-like paste. I rushed upstairs and I gummed the edge of my wah-wah mute, put my cheese all round it, climbed back on my wife's shoulders, thrust, there was a sort of a sound, and it stuck to the ceiling. and the little sponge of balsam dangled over my nose. This is only last night. But I did not snore last night at all. Isn't that marvellous? Mind you, I didn't get to sleep, but it's really getting used to the towel over the face that I don't see. So I thought you'd like to know. What was the line, Jim?
You come most carefully upon your art.
Oh, yes. So do remember, if you want to use my system, do remember that all this gadget won't stick to the ceiling with a dry rubber thing. Something you do first. You gum moist carefully upon your wawa.
Well, by your vote, Dennis Norden wins the contest of stories, and that brings us to a final score in which, nevertheless, Dillis Powell and Frank Muir get home by 4 marks and win, and it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶